Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Simone Riscala, and you are listening to the Endow Podcast, a conversation not just about the feminine genius in general, but about cultivating your particular feminine genius through the Catholic intellectual tradition and intentional community. Well, hello, Endow ladies. Simone here, Director of Program Growth, and I'm joined again with Mike Aquilina, and this time we're going to be talking about St. Joseph. So before we talked about the feminine genius in the early church, that was a really popular episode and that made me really happy. Now we're going to talk about the masculine St. Joseph, yeah. Guardian of the Redeemer. So Mike, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So good to have you back. And okay, I have to ask you, did you know there was going to be a year of St. Joseph?
I was joking to people that, of course, I knew. All I had to do was make a deposit to a numbered bank account at the Vatican Bank, you know. But that's not true.
I was like, "Where do you get your information? How do I get into that?"
So. What's funny is that our Holy Father made the announcement on the day that my book arrived in the warehouse.
You see the Holy Spirit, how good he is. Some people just walk in the light, Mike, and that's you. So, it was also perfectly crafted, but you are Italian, so I thought, well, maybe there's some sort of, there's like, could I be your conciliary? Anyway, so that was just awesome, and how exciting for that to be announced on the day he announced it, and also for the year of St. Joseph. So I feel like I haven't quite gotten into the year of St. Joseph as much as I could have by now. I mean, I've read parts of Pope Francis's letter. I'm working my way through it and praying St. Joseph litany, but I feel like I've yet to really embrace this special year. So maybe talking to you today can help me. And if there are any other women out there who are feeling like, yeah, I don't want to waste this like special time of grace and getting to know St. Joseph, but I don't quite know how to fit it into my busy schedule or like how to personalize it, if you will. I did do the consecration from Father Calloway last year, which was great. But now I feel like there's a new opportunity with your book and with this year of St. Joseph to delve in a little more deeply. So first I need to know, what inspired you, besides the Holy Spirit, to write a book about St. Joseph? So do the inner workings of your reflections.
This grew out of my devotion to St. Joseph. It's something I grew up with. My mother was intensely devoted to St. Joseph.
Wow.
You know, there... I'm Sicilian.
Yeah.
And there's a certain naming convention. There's a certain sequence you follow as you have children in naming the kids. And my brother, my older brother, was supposed to be named Joseph. No. My older brother was supposed to be named Salvatore. Okay.
Oh.
After my grandfather, my mother delivered very prematurely, which in 1954 was not a good thing. He had very little chance of survival. My mother went to St. Joseph and prayed to St. Joseph. And when my brother survived, as he did, and he's still thriving, my mother named him Joseph.
Aww.
Okay? Violating the convention.
Sorry, so, Grandpa. Yeah.
Well, 9 years later, I was born, you know, and I was supposed to be named Salvatore, and she named me Michael Joseph instead. She named me after my father and St. Joseph. Both.
Oh, wow. So your father's name is Michael Joseph too.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
So I'm the second. But this was just part of our life at home. My mother kept an image of St. Joseph in the house all through my childhood. That image is still in that house.
Wow.
And I always, when I look back at photos from that period, we must have, you know, got the best light for photographs right in front of that image, because I always say St. Joseph is always photobombing all through my childhood. You know?
Which is so unlike him as a hidden saint. Still.
He's making up for it now, I guess. At least.
Yes, exactly. He's like, my time has finally come. That is amazing. I mean, because, yeah, that's amazing. I don't think I really even started to hear about a devotion to St. Joseph until I lived in Virginia for a while, and a priest did a whole like go to Joseph homily. I think that's the first time I really started paying attention that was a thing, really.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that, like your mom's experience is more common? Is mine more common? I,
it's hard for me to say. You have to understand, I grew up in a Sicilian ghetto, right? And our parish was for the people from our villages. And it was staffed by the Oblates of St. Joseph.
Okay.
So everything in my childhood had a certain St. Joseph focus to it.
Got it.
The statues were there. The images were there. We were always hearing homilies about St. Joseph. The priests
were
intensely devoted to St. Joseph.
Wow.
And it was kind of a ghetto experience. We all lived together in this little neighborhood. That was the church I went to. And so between my mother and the Oblates of St. Joseph, I got this upbringing.
Yeah.
I don't know how typical that was. I suspect it wasn't all that typical in the United States of America during the baby boom.
Yeah, I don't think so. But so wait, backtrack. Did anyone get named Salvatore?
No. Well, I now have a son-in-law, who's named Salvatore, and they, my daughter and he have named their son Salvatore. So
okay, well,
caught up.
Poor grandpa, because I'm thinking of my friend. He's not Sicilian. He's from Naples, named Salvatore. And it was the naming thing is like a big thing. So I thought, oh no, hopefully I didn't get that little Sicilian temper there. You're very calm for a Southern Italian. So I don't know if your family says that. Mike, you're
Southern Italian. I'm Sicilian.
I'm so sorry. I know better than that, actually. I can't believe I made that mistake. But anyway, so St. Joseph has already been big in your life. So what would you say growing up in that ghetto experience was your relationship with him like? Was it just so natural that it just was part and parcel, even to think about it was strange? Or is there something more distinct to hold on to?
I don't think I ever thought about it. I don't, you know, it was just always there.
There.
And to me, it just seemed a natural thing that the Catholic faith had St. Joseph there at the center with the Blessed Virgin Mary. When it came time for me to be confirmed in fifth grade, I took the name Joseph.
Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? Of course you did.
Why complicated things. And I took my brother Joe as my sponsor. So,
oh my gosh. It was just what you were living and breathing.
That's right.
So for those of us that didn't have that experience, how do we cultivate that, do you think? Especially this year. So for the newer listeners that don't know, it's the year of St. Joseph. It's the 150th anniversary of St. Joseph being declared a patron of the Catholic Church by Pius IX. And so Pope Francis wanted to celebrate that anniversary. And also, you know, this whole COVID thing that we were experiencing and social unrest and all of the uncertainties, it's always good to have a father figure to look up to. And even beyond that, before even COVID was a thing and social distancing and all the kind of weird stuff that we have been experiencing last year and also this year. You know, fatherlessness is a real thing. It's a real problem. It's one of the worst things that, you know, the rotten fruits of the sexual revolution, of the disintegration of the family. 1 in 4, at least I can speak for American statistics, 1 in 4 families don't have a fatherly presence. That rate is much higher in African American families. So this is a huge problem. A lot of anger and anxiety out there, and trauma because of not having a father figure. And not having a father figure means that your relationship with Father God is also compromised. I mean, the layers and the relationships and the connections between all these things is very profound and very real. So I think we definitely need St. Joseph. So how can we cultivate that?
Well, St. Joseph doesn't make it too easy for us because he doesn't say anything on the record, right? So we don't have words of counsel coming from him. We've got to look to his deeds. And it's interesting what the Gospels tell us. We find out a little bit about him in St. Matthew's Gospel. Actually, St. Matthew is trying to reveal a lot about him, but it's so compressed that it's hard for us to unpack. And we don't find out about St. Joseph in the ordinary ways because we don't hear his words. You know, he's not speaking on the record. St. Matthew records no words of St. Joseph, and St. Matthew records no words, you know, by another human being, you know, being spoken to St. Joseph. It's as if, you know, the man went through life without conversations. Now, we know that's not true.
He was in the Middle East. He never could get a word in edgewise.
Man. Now, I couldn't say that, but you can.
I know I can say it. For St. Joseph. I've seen a lot of his kind in my circles.
So what I tried to do with my book is I tried to unpack the story that we find, especially in St. Matthew, but there are hints in the other Gospels as well, St. Luke and throughout, actually.
Yeah.
What they don't tell us about St. Joseph, what's between the lines, the way I do that is by giving the social and cultural and religious context for his life so we can understand his actions, because his deeds, his actions, are all we have to go on. If St. Joseph is a worker, you know, and we do see him work, we know he's that craftsman. You know, tradition tells us he's a carpenter. Well, what was it like to work as a carpenter in that place, in that time? What tools did they use? How did they get to work in the morning?
I love that. So the book title, and we'll link it, of course, is called St. Joseph and His World. And I absolutely love that you backtrack from his deeds and then to filling in the gaps with all of the, and I haven't finished reading it, so transparency, but I was so moved by that.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, this was what's interesting to me. How did he work? You know, how long were his work days? You know, what were his work weeks like? What were the days he had off, if he had any, right? Why did he have those days off? Then, you know, what was his religious training? What was his religious formation in terms of liturgy and that sort of thing? And how did that religious faith form him, prepare him for the events as they transpired in Matthew chapter 1, Matthew chapter 2, and St. Luke chapter 1 and chapter 2? There's so much that we can learn if we know the social, cultural, and religious context of St. Joseph's life. There's so much between the lines there in the stories in the gospel.
Yep. I just love that. I also thought it was so interesting. I didn't know that, of course, we know about Mariology as the branch of theology that focuses on Mary. I didn't know there were Josephologists, you know?
We have a great one here in the United States. His name is Father Joseph Korpening, and he's a Salesian priest in Philadelphia, and he does wonderful work. And a couple of the things he's done really speak to the concern you brought up earlier. Okay, he shows in several of his books that that devotion to Saint Joseph really came to flourish only with the discovery of the New World.
Mm.
And it came to flourish in the New World, first in Spanish America, and then in French Canada, right?
Wow.
And in Spanish America, it really came to flourish because of this epidemic of fatherlessness, that there were so many unwed mothers there because of the misbehavior of the conquistadors, but also of the diseases that were being introduced there. So many families were left fatherless and orphaned. And the good missionaries who came from the old country taught these fatherless children to look to St. Joseph and find a father there.
Wow.
This became a foundation for the culture. And then later on in French Canada, we find a similar thing happening. And it really comes to a wonderful kind of culmination with the construction of the oratory of St. Joseph.
I wish that I went there when I was a young teenager. I wish that I could have had the maturity at that time to pay more attention to the significance. I just didn't know that history, but I remember being really struck at it being really incredibly beautiful, and like revisiting André Bessette and all of that this past year has been so enriching. And I kind of want to take a year of St. Joseph pilgrimage and go back there and revisit that. But that is very interesting information. So how perfect is it now to have St. Joseph?
Especially for Americans, you know, yes. North Americans, South Americans, St. Joseph is our guy, you know, and we're the ones who really brought devotion to St. Joseph to the fore. I mean, there had been forerunners of this devotion down through the centuries, but it's in America that it really came to flourish.
Yeah, exactly. And I have this huge, I mean, of course, with Endow and the feminine genius and spiritual motherhood being the height of the feminine genius and so forth. But along with that comes the masculine genius and spiritual fatherhood and the real need for that. And I mean, it is heartbreaking seeing so much of the anger and the anxiety out there and the social unrest and the violence. And knowing that while everybody is keeping the conversation on very either like wrong categories and superficial categories or political categories, like the real wound is what has been stolen from these entire generations of fatherlessness. And gosh, we really, really need, so how do we backtrack? How do we renew culture? I mean, how do we get spiritual fathers out there for this father? How do we rely more deeply on St. Joseph? And and God the Father through him, because there is this real big wound and that needs to be healed.
Well, I think it's by following his example, okay? We don't have the words, again, we have the deeds.
Right.
How do you follow his example? Well, we know him to be a worker, right? We know him to be someone who was identified with, but he worked for the right ends. You know, I'm sure St. Yeah. Joseph was not workaholic because
yeah.
he loved his wife. That is so clear.
Wow.
From the New Testament narratives.
Wow.
He loved his wife. He loved his son. We know that from the New Testament narratives. So he teaches us to work for the right ends, to work for the sake of the family, to work for the sake of God. So I have a chapter in my book on St. Joseph and his work. And I talk about not only the tools he used, you know, not only the jobs he worked on, not only kind of the technical aspects of a construction job in first century BC, but also, you know, his attitude toward work as it was formed in his religious environment. Because the Jews were unique in the ancient world in placing a high value, very high value, on manual labor. This was really disrespected by the other ancient people. The Romans,
right.
The Egyptians, they looked down on manual labor. You know, the great thinkers who invented democracy didn't think that manual labor should have any part in democracy.
Yeah.
That was the work that was for slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Only the Jews, only the people of Israel had this value of work, and all their national heroes were laborers, right? If you go through the patriarchs of the Old Testament, they were men who worked with their hands before they became kings or whatever.
Right.
They were working with their flocks. They were doing things, right?
That's so interesting. And is that why that became a value within Judaism or the nation of Israel? Is that why?
Either way, I don't know. What we know is that there's this between the thought of ancient Israel and really the way this was lived out. In the time of St. Joseph, in his lifetime, really, this was the apex of that value, because the king who reigned during much of St. Joseph's life was Herod the Great. And why was he named the Great? One of the main reasons was that he was a great builder.
Mm.
He had these building programs that were vast. And for that, he needed craftsmen. He needed carpenters. He needed laborers. He needed men who worked with their hands. And he valued it so much, he paid them so highly, that they became known all through the Mediterranean region and the peoples in the countries all around there used to recruit laborers from the Holy Land because they wanted these people working on their construction projects.
Wow.
So really, this was a great time for a laborer like Joseph to be alive. There was a lot of opportunity, wages were high, and you were valued for what you did. Okay. And it seems to me that Joseph had that work-life balance.
Yes. I can't get away with it otherwise with Our Lady and our Lord. Like, there was really no other way.
So, he did his work, but he knew why he was doing it.
That is so huge. And I love the topic related to labor. I love the topic of leisure. And I love Joseph Pieper's book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. And just having that proper understanding of what work is for.
Oh, yeah.
and you know, work that for an end, and also the work of the Christian, which is prayer and contemplative work. You know, I agree with Pieper's, I'm sure you do, that leisure is the basis of culture, because without that kind of space, you know, workaholism is really the enemy of leisure, because without that space for God, for family, for the other, you know, then we've been relegated to undignified levels of existence. I mean, we always have our dignity as humans, but when we don't rest and pause and celebrate and worship, we have reduced our nature.
And St. Joseph had that built into his life, of course, as a devout Jew, okay? Because all labor, as we learn from the book of Genesis, God models labor for us.
Yes.
He has 6 days of work for the sake of the seventh day.
Yes.
Okay, all that work is ordered to leisure for the sake of worship.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph, all through those years of working hard during the world's greatest building boom, would have been laboring on 6 days for the sake of the seventh.
Yeah.
So that he could enjoy the Sabbath with his family and in the synagogue. he had that family time and the time for worship as a devout Jew that was built into his program of life, really.
I love that. And I love when I lived in Los Angeles, seeing the Orthodox Jews like walking to synagogue on Friday nights, and because they really took it so seriously, you know, and no electricity and that's an extreme form, right, of the Sabbath. But on the other hand, in such a consumeristic, workaholistic, worshiping work culture, it was so nice as a young adult at that time to see people really take their Sabbath seriously.
And I believe that's why St. Joseph and the Blessed Mother chose Egypt as their destination when they had to flee Herod.
Okay. Yeah.
It's quite likely. All the evidence seems to indicate that their own ancestors, their own families, had come quite recently from Babylon.
Right?
They were there from the time of the exile until they returned to the Holy Land in order to found these villages, right? Mm-hmm. Nazareth was founded about 100 BC. Amazing. And it's created out of the wilderness. There was nothing there. And suddenly there's this village that's peopled by the clan of King David, the descendants of King David. And Joseph and Mary were among those descendants. This is a great
thing. That just gives me chills.
Oh, yeah, you can see it's like God is moving everything.
Yes. It's all so dynamic.
For hundreds of years. And that's why I had so much fun doing this book, because you get to revisit that time and go into the little details to see how God was preparing his people, you know, for that moment when he would reveal himself in human form. So why Egypt? Why not Babylon? Well, in Egypt, there was a really rich Jewish culture. Jews made up about 4% of the population in Egypt at that time. And that's comparable to their percentage of the American population right now. So if they went to Egypt, they could be sure to find neighborhoods, villages, entire villages, suburbs, where they might raise their child in a place and among a people who were congenial to the faith, who could live the life and model the life for him. They were thinking.
Yes, they're ghettos. They had their Jewish ghettos there that they could be part of, incorporate into the community.
Two of the major neighborhoods in Alexandria at that time were Jewish ghettos, were these neighborhoods where the Jews could live together and live by the law.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph and Mary knew what they were doing when they chose that destination. Even though it was a longer journey and a more perilous journey, they took that road. And they went to the place where they could raise a child as a good Jew, and he could live that life that was labor ordered to leisure and worship.
Oh, so incredible. I just love that Jesus' childhood was in Egypt. You know, it's just so special. It's just so neat. And I've been to that area in Cairo where the Holy Family stayed. And yeah, I mean, it's so rich because everybody there knows what it's about. Everybody there knows what it's about, because when you're persecuted, you hang on to all of the everything that is meaningful for your faith and for your culture and for your life. So, okay. So you conceived of this idea to do this book on St. Joseph. And one of the things I appreciate is in the beginning, you talk about the sources and what sort. So where did you start in research? Because at Endow, one of the things we pride ourselves on is that we're actually reading sources. Like we're reading the actual writing of the saint or papal documents, magisterial documents. Like we want that our community likes to, you know, read the actual primary sources. So where did you go in your sources for this? Because there's so much not available, at least explicitly, because of Joseph not really speaking in the Gospels. where did you go? Where did you start? Because you said you had fun with this. So where did the fun begin?
I mean, first I tried to get a sense of that period from the sources that we have from that period, the Jewish sources that we have from that period, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, from the works of Josephus, from the works of Philo, from the intertestamental literature.
Wow.
I tried to get as much as I could from the documents that were produced by faithful Jews in that time. And I tried to read the history. I read all the biographies of King Herod in that.
That is so cool. That's so cool.
Yes. I found him to be such a fascinating figure because he was a genius in so many ways. I mean, he was a genius at diplomacy. Here is a man who negotiated successfully with Caesar Augustus, Cassius, Mark Antony, Cleopatra. He was a player on the international scale, also a great builder. He rebuilt the Jerusalem temple till everyone knew right. that it was greater than it had been in the time of King Solomon. He outdid Solomon in its vastness and in its beauty. He was a genius, and he was a sick ticket. You know, the guy was just messed up. He
was. I was going to say, that is the way you describe him is so foreign to the way that I've been thinking about Herod, who, you know, you see this like childish, narcissistic, violent, money, you know, power hungry, you know, murderer. But, you know, here he is. I didn't even know there were biographies about King Herod, like to that extent.
A lot of good ones. And he was called Herod the Great even while he was still alive.
Yeah.
He wanted to impress his greatness upon the people he ruled, but also on his neighbors.
Yes. Okay?
Keep them respectful of his right. space. Right?
Right.
So two ways he did that. One was by these magnificent buildings, mm-hmm. to strike awe in the people who saw these buildings, to make them gasp.
Yes.
That's one way. The other way was by massacres. By making people fear him, by knowing that he would stop at nothing. If you stood in his way, he would kill you and he wouldn't even think about it. Now, on one particularly bad day, he killed 300 of his military leaders.
See, that's more how I was thinking about Herod. But yeah, there's an evil genius there, right?
Like he was famous for his massacres. He killed he killed three of his sons. He killed his mother-in-law. He killed, a brother-in-law. He killed his favorite wife. He had her killed.
So weird.
So many of his family members. Once he had two rabbis burned alive, and then he had all of their disciples rounded up, and he had them publicly executed to make examples of them. Another time, he called the Jerusalem Council to consider the question of whether he might be the Messiah. And you could tell he already had his answer in mind.
Right. See, that level of narcissism was where I was going.
But when they voted against him, when they said, no, that's not possible, he had all those people who voted that way rounded up and destroyed.
Yeah.
And he kept one person alive and blinded him so that he could live forever, live on as an example.
Oh, geez. Wow.
That's the thing. You know, Scott Hahn, in his foreword to my book, points out that my book is kind of presenting these two men on parallel tracks, you know?
Yes.
There's the life of Herod, and there's the life of Saint Joseph, but they're almost going in different directions,
yes.
you know? The same rate of speed. It's a fascinating figure in history. So you asked about sources and you got me going, right?
Yeah, I know. It's awesome.
I wanted to get into this period. So those primary sources were the first place I went, the biographies of Herod, but also archaeology from that period. I read a lot of works of archaeologists who have worked in Nazareth, who have worked in Jerusalem, and who have a lot to say about how things were done in that period, how carpentry was done, how agriculture was done. All of that figures into the story.
Wow. I make up that this whole process was so meditative and prayerful and contemplative for you because you're like, is that true?
It's true.
That's so awesome.
To me, it's important to feed the imagination so yeah. that all of these things that were revealed by God through the evangelist Matthew, the evangelist Luke, they come from God, you know,
yeah.
and they have infinite depths. In order to sound those depths, we've got to feed the imagination.
Yes.
We've got to flesh out the scenes and see more of the background, see more of the foreground. And this is the way I do it. I read, I get into the scenes a little bit that way. I've had the opportunity to visit a lot of the biblical sites, and that's been a great advantage.
Yes.
That's how I.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, what a service that you've done for the church in terms of this book, where the fruit of all your contemplation and study in this handy dandy book you can order on Amazon or whatever. But I'm jealous, Mike, because that whole journey that you took reading all this, discovering all this, imagining, praying, thinking, making the connections, like that's such an incredible incredible experience. So I have some holy jealousy over here because
I have kind of a holy jealousy for myself because I almost wish I could go back and do it again. You're never quite pleased with the final product. And there's so much that you'd like to go deeper into, but the public is on the other end waving a contract at you, telling you to get it in on a certain day. So.
Yes, I definitely relate to that, where you just never feel satisfied with all the research because you the more you research, the more you know there is to research, and there's but still that's pretty. Maybe there'll be a part two. Who knows? You never know. But I guess our research will never end if we didn't have that person saying, hey, deadline, you have to make a choice. Well, this has been great. I guess before we say goodbye, because I again, of course, one of those conversations where I want to pick your brain about a million other things, but do you talk about in the book, or what do you think about the whole debate about was Joseph a young man or an old man? What's your opinion on that?
One thing that I try to make clear in the book is that the church has not declared one way or another on this question.
Right.
And it's a matter of serious dispute, right? Mm-hmm. And he liturgically remembered in certain ways that we should respect because they're part of the liturgy, okay? Mm-hmm. I do have an opinion.
Well, that's what I'm getting at.
What I try to do in the book is give the context within the whole church, East and West, right? And then say that I have an opinion. It's my opinion. I have good reasons for holding this opinion.
Yes.
I think I do anyway, and I give you what those reasons are. But I don't force you to take my conclusion.
Yes.
That's the way I treat it in the book. I definitely have an opinion, and probably because it's so near and dear to my prayer, it's a strong opinion. But I think we go wrong when we let our passions take over in these matters of legitimate dispute.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I asked what your opinion was, not, because I know the church doesn't proclaim anything about this. But I have an opinion and my mother has an opinion. So Mike, you've got to settle this for us. You have to be on my side, Mike.
Well, I don't know what your side is, but I'll tell you, I think he was a young man.
Okay. Okay. I win because my mother loves you, Mike. So, I'm going to keep that for one of our passionate conversations, and I'll pull that card out at the right moment in a charitable, kind, and patient way. But she's, the Egyptian, the East, they think he's older. So
that's right. And that's why I try to be very respectful because again, they're reading these texts in their liturgy, and they have been reading these texts in their liturgy since probably the second century. So I want to be very, very respectful of people who disagree with me on this, even though I have a strong suspicion they're wrong.
Yeah, there we go. Can you give me your top three reasons?
One is just the arduous journeys that we find just in the gospel accounts. Okay.
Yeah.
That if Joseph was in his 90s, as some sources say he was, it would be a hard thing for him to make that little journey, relatively little journey, from Nazareth to Bethlehem on those roads at that time. That would have been difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
The journey to Egypt would have killed him, I think, because it was so long. We're talking about a journey of more than 1,000 miles on very primitive roads. Okay?
Right.
And you're traveling by night, and you're traveling with brigands, watching out for people to rob, and you're in hiding, and you're under a lot of stress. I think for St. Joseph to do the work he did, as we see it in the New Testament, he had to be a young man. Now, I know that the saints have other reasons, which I also like, for believing that he had to be a young man. And that is so that he could, enter history as an icon of chastity, a masculine chastity. I have a strong suspicion that the figure of the older Joseph was introduced in order to counter first the rabbinic attacks upon the Blessed Virgin's divinity. Okay.
Yeah.
That they tried to cast doubt upon that by showing Joseph to be a harmless old man like me, all right? you know, that was an apologetic strategy.
Yeah.
To understand why the ones who wrote the apocryphal accounts of Joseph's life, understand why they went in that direction. I don't think it was good in the long run, because it kind of just reinforces the idea that a man can't be chased.
Yes, you know? I was going to say that, and they certainly can. So, yes.
Something that's possible, and St. Joseph shows it to be possible, you know? Yeah. So I like the idea of the vigorous Joseph, the masculine Joseph, the hardworking Joseph.
Yes, and a picture of the Holy Family that just looks a little evened out. Anyway, but there's no schism over here in the Riscala home about it, but, you know, it'll be fun to have that conversation again. So St. Joseph's feast day is coming up later this week. How do you celebrate St. Joseph? How does a Sicilian celebrate St. Joseph?
You know, I don't have any particular way. In our house, we celebrate everything with a dessert, you know?
Yes. That's great.
I kind of learned that if they reminded their parents of dessert or showed a certain astuteness in their understanding of the calendar, that their parents would probably make a dessert or buy a dessert that day. So we always recognize things with dessert. Other than that, I do try to do a novena of the Sundays before St. Joseph's Day, 9 Sundays before St. Joseph's Day.
Oh, so not just 9 days before the 19th, but 9 Sundays before.
Yeah.
See?
Nice preparation.
What does one Google to get that novena? Is there something special? Where did that come from?
I first heard about it from a priest of Opus Dei. So I imagine that it's either a Spanish custom or it's just a custom within Opus Dei. So I imagine that if you Google it, you'll find some texts.
Okay. If I find it, I'll link it to this interview. I'll Google Opus Dei, St. Joseph Sundays and see what happens. So that's great. There's like so much, get overwhelmed in the Catholic world with all the different ways you can spread this devotion. But if ever there was a time, well, thank you, Mike. Any last thoughts? And thank you again for writing this book and doing this for us.
No, I mean, my only thought is to urge people to get back into the texts, to read the Bible and strive to read it with understanding. You know, this is just one book. There are many books out there that are designed to get you into the scenes and to live the scenes as if you were there as an eyewitness, because that's what God wants. That's why he revealed these things, so that it didn't just happen long ago and far away. It happened in your life as one of your memories, and he's God, so he can make that happen.
Oh, I love that. That's very Jewish of us. It's in our memory. It's in our spiritual DNA. It's what we're living here and now. I love it. Thank you so much, Mike. And I hope that you're back on the Endow podcast again soon.
Well, thank you for having me this time. I'll come back anytime you call.
Thank you. If this episode was helpful for you, I would love it if you'd share it with your friends. I would also love to hear your comments and feedback, so please email me at simone.riscala@endowgroups.org, or feel free to reach out to us on any of our social media platforms. Remember, you are the heart of Endow.